All right, this is lesson number 45 in our long series, and this is 6 of 18 we do in the spring, so we got one-third of the way through. I don't know why I do this, because as soon as I'm done with one series, I go to another one, so there's never an end to this, which is good, I guess. So we are in, every lesson to me is an exciting lesson. You know, it's almost like we're standing on the shore of the Red Sea, and the Lord's going to part the water so the children of Israel can go through, except that this is 3,500 years later, and it's not Moses, it's a few other people that God has lined up to do his work, but just as surely is God involved in what's going on here as he was 3,500 years ago when the children of Israel went into the promised land for the first time. Now they're being prepared to go into it for the second time, albeit with unbelief yet, which is how the Bible explains it will be, and then in time they will come to believe in the Messiah, which I won't get the details now. So we see what happened in May 15, 1948 is something that was prophetically fulfilled, a prophetic prophecy fulfilled, and since the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 A.D., 135 A.D., that's the first thing that ever had been fulfilled in the Bible that you could say that is that. So it's really quite remarkable to think about that. I lived through that time. I wish I would have been more aware of what's going on. Maybe I was. I forgot. But then I think, well, maybe not everybody really understood the impact of those days back in 1948 when I was only 11 years old. I could have been aware. What I came to know about it, I came to understand later. So it wasn't like I knew at that time that everybody's talking about it in the street. It wasn't that way as I remembered at all. I think that people that were into prophecy talked about it a lot. They had to have talked about it a lot. So we're a little late coming to it, but that's okay. So it's exciting to see what God is doing in the lives of people that are not even aware that God's using them to accomplish his purposes, which is nothing new. God always or often has worked that way. And so in the 20th century, the same is true again. As we get into our study tonight, we are going to go as far as the recognition of Israel as a nation. And there's some pieces of that time that we'll deal with next week, and you know, already have too much for today. So we don't want to miss any of salient parts here. So that's why I say we'll trace back a little bit next week and pick up some things that we haven't done in our lesson today, which I might mention those to you as we go through it, or I may not. It just depends on. All right, so we have a nation born in one day. That's where we're going today. We've been following three streams that ends up being in one current. We have the Christian stream, we've had the Jewish stream, we've got the Gentile or the political stream we're following. We are now particularly following the political stream. When it comes into the political stream, we're talking about the government, the governments, not only our government, United States, but governments in the world. And I've talked to you about individuals that God has used in a special way to advance his plan. And I thought I better start writing these down. Maybe someday we'll even do a lesson on it. It depends on how many lessons we have left in the series. But the notables really in the Christian stream aren't personalities as such. I have Henry VIII up there, but it's almost not him, but somehow the time. But he did something very important, made the Bible available to the people who, up until that time in the Catholic Church, had the reading of the Scriptures was restricted. In fact, that's really true until Vatican II in 1962. So the Scriptures were really foreign to the people. And when Henry VIII said, the Pope's not going to be the head of the church, in fact, he said, I am, which I'm not sure he improved it any. But he said, since I am the head of the church, I want an authority to run the church. And he said, well, what would be the authority we should use? And somebody in the back row said, the Bible. And not making a joke. And that made sense. We should take the Bible for what it says, and it became the authority. So we don't have individuals here in the Christian realm, although there are people. But none like in the others. So we have movements like the Restoration Movement, which realized as they read the Bible there was a future for Israel. And the prophecy for Israel had not yet been fulfilled. And then we move from futurism, we call it historicism at that time, Restorationism was also called historicism because they saw the Bible being fulfilled historically. And they gave up on that and finally came, not everybody, the right group gave up on that and came to a position called futurism, which is where we are. So many of the things that have not happened yet or haven't happened in the Bible because they're still future. So that's the Christian. Then we have the Jewish, which is just run through these real quick. Theodor Herzl was the first one to start the Zionist movement in 1897. We have Chaim Weizmann, or Chaim, however you want to say his name, Weizmann, or Weizmann, would be the first president after Herzl. And then we have Eddie Jacobson, who was a haberdasher in Kansas City, just down the road from us, and he becomes a very important person in the development of the Jewish thread. Then from the Gentile side, or from the political side, we have, of course, Lord Balfour and George. Then we have Woodrow Wilson in America, our president, around 1920. We have British Winston Churchill, and a stick sort of underneath the covers here, Joseph Stalin. He does become a part here, but I think he probably could have survived without Stalin. And we have Harry S. Truman, which we could not have survived, or the system could not have survived without him. And of all these people here, on the basis of obstacles to overcome, Truman is easily the most essential personality that God used in forming the Jewish state. Put them all together, Truman, on the basis of obstacles, see what I'm saying? On the basis of obstacles he faced, he made the greatest contribution. Now we're going to do this in two parts. I'm going to introduce to you Russia, and I say it's time to introduce Russia, and I might add, of all things. Russia does play a part in this, and this is new for me. I have to admit that reading this was kind of exciting. I never understood exactly this part of it. So we're going to talk about Russia in the background, then we'll come back at the end of the lesson and put the finishing touches on it. So I don't want you to lose track of our first part here. You're looking at the Kremlin here. And the Kremlin is really quite an interesting place. There are three churches on the Kremlin. There's one where you're born into. There's one where you're married. And there's one where they bury you. And you can see all three of those churches if you look at it carefully from this picture. And then you have the office building. Are you counting out? They're there. So I didn't know that. And you're looking from the Moscow River across the river towards the Kremlin. And around the corner, the little tower you see there is where Lenin is buried, so the one on the right. We're not going to talk about that. Just interesting stuff. Okay, here's our personalities, and I've made a little shift here. I moved FDR off to the side and moved in his successor, Harry Truman, in his place. So this is the diplomatic corps. Now, the Russian factor. By now, 1948, we kind of look at that period, 47, 48, since 1924, Russia has been Stalinist Russia. Stalinist Russia. And Stalinist Russia was different than Leninist Russia. Stalinist Russia was very, very hard on its people. 20 million people died under his regime. Before the revolution in 1917, the Tsarist Russia was Christian-based, as were all the European nations. Russia became a Christian probably. Andrews is supposed to have been the disciple that went to the Slavic people. But then it got lost, and so Christianity was reinduced again in about 1100 AD. So we have, we kind of start from there with modern history. So we considered Christian in the sense that it wasn't Buddhist or it wasn't Hindu. It was Christian in a broad sense, like we talk about European Christian. However, the ideas of Engels and Marx, middle 1800s, were a challenge to Christianity and its way of doing things. And it began to appeal to the intellectuals who were anxious to shed the burden of God, which is in Christianity, sought to explain things as atheists, or another word for atheism or atheists is materialists. Now, materialism, it has two definitions. One of it is we sometimes talk about as Christians, we don't want to be materialistic in our values, things are not that important. That's not the kind of materialism we're talking about here. Materialists are those that believe that all there is material. It started with, I don't know where, a big bang, I guess, and then we have this material. So everything is limited to what the material is and what it does. So another word for this would be the Darwinist or the evolutionist. So they're actually called materialists. And that's really what communism is. So in the early 20th century, the Russian Tsar, Nicholas II, was in great trouble. Russia was in great trouble. The old order of faith in the divinely appointed king broke down under the assault of the socialists led by Vladimir Lenin. By the way, he was a Jew. They think he probably was a Jew. On July 17, 1918, Tsar Nicholas II and his family were summarily executed by the Red Communists after the October 1918 revolution, which is the second one that year, the white one first and then the red one. Totalitarian communism reigned unchallenged in Russia until 1989. So communist Russia promotes a socialism ideology. Socialism ideology. And sorry that so many people today don't understand what socialism is. We're living it, frankly, a lot of it, democratic socialism. So communist Russia promotes a socialism ideology as the panacea for the world. By contrast, Tsarist Russia sought common border or territorial wars, kind of normal things that nations do. The Reds fought to export their ideology of socialism as a world system. They weren't just content to have it in their country. It immediately became necessary to export it. Now, socialism, if you don't know what it is, it actually, the main thing it does is eliminate private property. And if you think you own your private property today, anytime you pay a tax on your private property, you're not owning that part. So it depends on how big it gets. Let's not get off the track here. So we have the loss of private property, the main issue, and with it goes the loss of personal freedoms, and the freedoms of religion and economic go with it. All right? Now remember, back in the days, early in this fall, or spring, or winter, whatever we're in here, remember the riots in Jaffa in May 1, 1921, the disturbances were started by Jewish communists agitating amongst the non-communist Jews. So there was a Jewish communist connection. We're talking about Russia and the Jews. We talked about that a little bit. Now, we have maintained that there was a large number of Jews in Russia, Poland, you know, the pogroms in 1881 and on. Add that the fact that Jews are cut off from God, their heritage, the creator God, in that vacuum, they become atheistic leaders. You know, if you don't have a God, what are you going to be? You're going to be atheistic. So they start shaping socialistic ideology, leading to the October 17 revolution. Now, noted that Russian Jews wish to export communism, promoted communism to their Jewish brothers at Jaffa, okay? Now, just for your information, to finish this thought here, the revolution out of Marx was the way forward. Revolution was the way forward with Marx. The tactic that has been replaced by revolution, I'm talking about armed revolution, is infiltration and subversion. And we have that very well outlined by this guy named Saul Alinsky. And that is the present socialist weapons. You don't have worried that somebody's going to overthrow our government. We see that there's infiltration from inside to corrupt it from inside, and it's very effective. The Russian factor. In 1948, the communists had exported their revolution to include these essential European states. They were moving west, pushing toward the Europe and Mid-East. Mid-East would be below Bulgaria and so forth. You see a part of Turkey sticking in the map. Remember that the motivation for this implementation was an ideology is much stronger, the ideology motivation is much stronger than just simple imperialism, which is a country just looking after its own national interest. So, I just wanted to mention to you Yugoslavia down here. We'll talk about that next week, because one of the issues that we're not going to talk about tonight is where in the world did the Jews get all their arms? Well, I'll tell you now, Yugoslavia is one place where they got them from. All right, we'll talk about that today. We don't have time. So that'll be next week. Now, we're still talking about Russia. Now we're going to add England to the mix. Russia has interest in the Middle East, that is the Palestine region, because of its strategic location. We've talked about that many times, how that Levant or Palestine is in the threshold of three continents. You've got the African continent, the Asian continent, and the European continent. If you want to go between those three, you've got to go through the Levant, that area we call Syria or Palestine today. So Russia has interest in that area. England certainly has interest in that area. So Russia has interest in the Middle East because of its strategic location. It has the same importance to England. Blue on the map versus the red on the map shows the hegemonies of each. You see the blue here in England up here, and we have the blue down here in northern Africa with Egypt and the Levant. And we go further east, we get into India. But we're mostly concerned with this area down here. All right, so Palestine is connected. Here's Palestine. Hardly can see it. Almost a wide line width pencil line width line on the map. That's all it is. But it's connected to Egypt down here. So in a sense, this is all one unit. And then in this is the Suez Canal. And it opens up south to the Indian Ocean. And further east, it goes to India and the eastern markets. So England occupied Egypt since 1882 and took the Levant from the Turks. We read about that, studied about that in 1918, World War I. And then as the liberators, the British received the mandate from the nations, international nations, to make a homeland for the Jews. So England is very, very much involved in the Levant legitimately. By 1948, the British, now this is the pivotal point here. By 1948, the British looked bad to the world for their failure to provide for the Jewish refugees who are still languishing in displaced person camps. The Russian intend to capitalize on this weakness. So hold that thought, because now we're going to come back to it at the end of our lesson. So Russia wants to capitalize on England's failure. England looks really bad. It's an opportunity to move into the Levant. Keep that thought. Now we're going to return to the mandate. Now, there are two choices as the mandate expires or is abandoned, however you want to look at it, quits operating. There are two choices with the land. They've already divided the land and gave some of it to Jordan, which is the Jordan, modern-day Jordan, the Hashemite kingdom of Jordan. And they have this little notch of a land left. We're going to talk about that little notch of land. Someone called it that. And what are you going to do with it? There's two choices. One is to subdivide it yet again for the last time, or leave it together and then administer it as a unit with mixed people living in it. So you have either partition it or you have a extended custodialship of it, which is what it's been under with British since 1921, 22, somewhere in there. So I put that up there, petition or trusteeship. And trusteeship means not divided. So you're not maybe promoting trusteeship as much as you're against dividing it. Because dividing it is what is the obstacle here. Leave it together is conventional wisdom by some. All right, so those are the two choices. Now, we have these important events. I put them up on the board here, and I maybe refer to them, I won't, I don't know. But we start with Truman on April 12, 1945. That's when he comes to office. So we got the new kid on the block. Things are different now. And he starts seeing Israel from a different line light than FDR did. And by the way, I've not talked about Eleanor here, Eleanor Roosevelt. She was very, very pro-Zionist. She was very much in favor of the Jews having their own state. I wonder if she ever talked to her husband. And in other words, she was right on this one. So, in fact, she actually joined organizations that promoted Zionism. So I just wanted to mention that because credit is there and its credit is due. Remember, we had October 6th, Yom Kippur, the day of Yom Kippur. Just before that, Truman states that he's going to support an Israel state, which means a divided land, not a trusteeship. I'm not sure how much it's developed in his mind, but that's the first time where it said, remember, he went to the synagogues and told them that's what he was going to do, and the synagogues broadcast it to all the synagogues in the United States or wherever, that this is what he was going to say on Yom Kippur Day. So the rabbis, when they got up and talked to the congregation, they told them this new news. You can imagine how it spread like wildfire. Well, that's October 46. Valentine's Day, 47, British decides they're going to abandon the mandate. So, you know, it's sort of like, you know, remember last week, talk about how much Truman was putting pressure on, not Churchill, but Attlee and Bevins to admit these 100,000 people, and they wouldn't budge, and he kept on putting pressure on them, kept on putting pressure on. So when he makes a statement, they respond by saying, okay, we're going to get out of it. So then they're out of it then. They're not really acting out of it. The UN votes then on November 29, 1947, to partition. And we have this on this box here. So those are the kind of important dates here that are not too hard to remember. One's Valentine's Day, one is Yom Kippur Day. And I guess when it comes to November 29, you just have to remember that one. It's after Thanksgiving. In fact, it was delayed. It was going to go before Thanksgiving Day, and it was delayed two more days, plus the weekend. So, and I'll talk about that in a minute. So it's around Thanksgiving Day. That'd be a good way to remember it. So the UN Resolution number 181 is the resolution that partitions the land. Now, so many things to say. I got to say this here. Remember, UN has no authority to do this. UN has no authority to do this. So let's just remember that. Because they have no authority to do this. It was divided by nations, and the divisions still stand. It was Israel land. There's no doubt about it. And we'll talk about that a little bit later when Truman goes for additional help. But when we talk about the UN doing the partitioning, it means diddly squat. But it was recognized. And when it's recognized by other nations, then it gets some legs. But it can't do anything. It's impotent. All right. So November 29, 1947, the United Nations votes to recommend partitioning. See, they recommend, that's the right word. Recommend partitioning the land as it was described into a Jewish state and into an Arab state. The vote for the partition was 33-4, 18 against. That's about two-thirds. 10 abstain. One was absent. I don't know where that guy was that day. But if he would have been there, he would have voted for it. I don't know who it even is. So we got an affirmative vote here and a decisive choice here. And I don't know if we can talk about this or not, but there's a lot of politics going on behind the scenes. And as I said, the vote got delayed. Well, let's delay till after Thanksgiving because the evening of Thanksgiving, like on Wednesday, said, let's don't do it now. Well, let's wait till after Thanksgiving. It came to Friday. Well, that's the weekend. Let's wait till after the weekend. So we got Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday before the vote was taken. I think it was on Monday before the vote was taken. And there's some changes were made in that four-day period that probably changed the outcome of this. So we have from Britain, Bevan, Secretary of State type, informs Marshall on the day before this vote was taken that they're going to withdraw their troops and administrative support on May 15. So you can see they're not really playing along very well. They're pretty stubborn about what they're doing. So rather than wait till the vote is done, then we can decide that before the vote's even taken, already know that they're going to be out of it. Okay, the events. From the time of Britain's intention to withdraw from the mandate, February 14, 1946, the posturing between the advocates for partitioning and those for custodialship were enormous. I just had mentioned that. Truman notably tried to keep out of the UN vote, thinking that would be the honorable thing to do. But when it looked like partitioning may not have the votes, he released his hounds on behalf of the petition plan. He personally didn't do anything, I don't think, but it was others that did it for him or for the cause. Now, this issue of being held hostage, I mean, you still hear that today somehow that the Middle East has the rest of the world by our neck. There was an equally aggressive fear-mongering campaign going on from the anti-partition State Department and the British. To wit, should the Arabs be offended, the oil from the Saudi fields will become unavailable. Oh my, we won't have any gas for our cars. Now, counter this, and we didn't hear this, we should have heard it, the Saudis sold 90% of their oil to the United States. Now, it will be a cool day in July if they gave up their lucrative income over a principle. But we never know, right? And I'd say it's kind of like waterboarding. Sometimes the guy's got to come up for air. And if you cut off the oil, I mean, we may not have the oil for a while. We may have to walk, but the Saudis will come back pretty soon. Well, by the way, we thought it over again, and we got some bills to pay, so we're going to be sipping you some oil. So this being held hostage over the oil thing, to me, now that I've studied this, really been a fear-mongering. There's nothing to be worried about because it might have been difficult for a little bit, but no one would have gone to war over it. And somewhere else, I say this one, another assumption about this Middle East air is that all the Arabs walk in goose step. They do not. You get two Arab groups to agree, you got a miracle. And Nasser tried to put them together, Assad tried to put them together, and when they actually go to war, later on we'll talk about this, when they actually go to war against Israel, they even lie to each other when they're going to war. That's how Jordan got into the war, because NASA told them, yeah, we're winning over here. Just go ahead and jump in. Well, the truth of it is that NASA was done. So anyway, all this stuff going on, and there's no reason why the West has to be held hostage because of oil. And now, especially, we have a glut of oil in the world. They'd say, I search some gas going to go down to a dollar? And this is supposed to hang around for a year yet, so go ahead and buy your SUVs. But look at the shrinking Israel over the time. We start out with the brown. That was all Israel. It was all Israel. That was the land given to Israel. Well, they get the green, it gets knocked off here. Well, that's Jordan, the Hashemite kingdom of Jordan. Well, during the time, you know, some of this stuff with wars is over. This is 1973. Israel takes over the Sinai Peninsula again. And they did it already in 67. And so you have these, they give back the land for peace, right? That's the word, right? Land for peace. Give land for peace, land for peace, land for peace, land for peace. We still don't have any peace. The only way you get land for peace, you could give it all away. But I'm just saying, look at the difference there is in the shrinkage of this land. And we started out with this peace. Amazing. All right, so now the question of partition or trusteeship. The posturing exactly where, remember, this has got to be decided, where the borders are going to be exactly. Where will they be drawn? And I just told you to remember the original mandate where they were. Now look, we've got this whole seen cow here. Now remember, you have to have defensible borders. If you got a border that's, you know, 1 mile wide and 200 miles long, it's not going to work. So you have to have some kind of borders that you can defend. Now, Truman played an important role in finding the borders that were favorable to the Jewish interest, including the Negev and the Aqaba. Weissman was very instrumental in that. So this the Aqaba down here, the desert. You see, this was what called the Minority Report from this United Nations Special Committee on Palestine, USCOP. Well, this is the minority report, because in official report, there were others that had been floated. The British had one. I just brought you these two. And this is one that's pretty much like it was submitted to and was voted on by the UN. So you see a lot more area here in a contiguous area than we see over here. And then you have a sliver along here, and this is almost impossible. And then you have some more up here. This yellow ochre part is actually what's Israel. So the question of trusteeship or division here. Now, I think we did this. November 28 was the announcement to depart from the British to depart from the mandate by May 15. The vote in November 29, Thanksgiving time. Then we got 5.5 months during this time. The anti-partition voters, after the UN had voted, they weren't done. Then they still went to work to try to change the vote. The anti-partition voters go to work, and this is in the State Department. We could name guy like Loy Henderson, George Marshall, and I forget his first name right now. They work to reverse the UN vote or make implementing the vote impossible, even to the extent that they would subvert the president's partition intention. Okay, so the question is simply to partition the land or not. Not to partition means that the land will continue under some kind of trusteeship, as the British are going to abandon. What is not given in the not partition option is who will be the trustee. Somebody has to do this. England hasn't been too successful with it. So the UN has no authority to order another nation or a trusteeship to assume that responsibility. The British have said no. The United States president wants partition, surely he will not want the trusteeship. And even the Russians, we find out, want it partitioned. All right, but the key element of this trusteeship is the key element of it is unknown. We don't know who's going to do it, but they want to do it. But who's going to do it? If you don't have that answer, you can't do the trusteeship, which becomes apparent later. Now, one of the hard things kind of about this period of time is there was so much war going on in this area. I call them drama of small wars. This is a little map. You can read that. It tells you how many Jews and how many Arabs were killed in each one of these spots. You know, and you have to get into the hundreds, maybe thousands, probably, maybe not thousands, certainly into the hundreds of people that were killed in these little skirmishes. While these wars have been going on during the British mandate period, we will focus in my little discussion here. We'll talk about that from after the mandate, after the partition was voted on and up to the time when Israel became a nation. So those 5.5 months. We could skip this, but the tragedies are really real and make the decision making more difficult as the Arabs' resistance becomes very, very fierce and the Jews react to this fierce Arab attack, even with one bad massacre, which makes the Jewish cause less convincing. So you have these things that are going on. When people start killing each other, it's not pleasant. So another two maps, these are, one was in March of 48, next one is from April 1 to May 14. And you see that the area that's light here is where the Arabs were attacking the Jews, and the dark areas where the Jews were counterattacking the Arabs. So you see it, a lot of areas here. And I might notice here, and I'll say it a little bit later, you never see any of these attacks going on in what will be the Arab territories. They're always just in the Jewish territories. Who's doing the attacking, you wonder? All right, during this time, the violence was Arab on Jew. The Jew on Arab violence was in retaliation for unprovoked aggression by the Arabs. I suppose there's an exception somewhere, but that's generally how it was. Jews weren't out killing people. All right, notice that all the violence was in the partition zones. We probably don't have that map shown to you very well here, but it's all on the west side, out of the partitioned area, partitioned for the Arabs, that is. Further, the Jews did not expel any Arabs who did not evacuate their properties in 1948. I said something the other day about in Yalta, or I'm sorry, in the Potsdam, when the Western powers divided up Europe and said, you know, these borders will be here, and these people will go here, and these people will go here, moving people around. And I said, you know, you can do that in Europe, but you can't move one Arab in the Middle East. And I said, the problem with my statement was they didn't even move one Arab in the Middle East. They were all able to stay. Now, some have got into their, you know, got on their little mule and rode out, but no one forced them out. Now, when they wanted to come back in, now that was a different issue. They had abandoned their property, and there had been a war in between time. There was nobody holding your place. All right. So after the resolution 181, the Arabs feel more threatened, obviously, and continue to make nearly daily attacks on the Jewish territories. The borders were set, and the Jewish defense forces, by the way, were not consolidated yet into the IDF, the Israel Defense Force. Were not consolidated. There were three groups, and some were quite militant, and some were more moderate. Well, they were taking on the national duties of self-defense. As difficult as it is to accept the death of hundreds of Jews and Arabs, what remains is that the Jews learned how to defend their borders. This demonstration gave the United Nations gave strong assurances that the partitioning plan indeed will work. Very key importance, because you declare yourself as a nation, you can't defend yourself, you won't last long. You went to kill a lot of people for no reason. I mean, nothing comes out of it. But if the Jews can defend their territory, you don't have to bring in the troops from America or from England or from wherever, France. That's a winner for the UN. So it looks like they can take care of themselves. Without these exercises in real attacks, I call a small army, small wars, the Jewish defenses would not have been prepared for what they faced on May 15. Very important part. Now, we're not going to talk about the Jewish armaments. This is what I can't go by. I don't have time for tonight. But it's very interesting how they got the armament. In fact, that's a study, fascinating study. In fact, there's been movies on it on TV. You might want to look up sometimes how they got their armaments. Well, it came from everywhere, and probably a lot of them illegally, because remember, you don't know this yet, but there was an arms embargo on it, Marshall, and placed on Israel. You know, kinds of retaliation against Truman. Okay, so we have Truman and the State Department. And I thought you'd like to see these guys and immortalize their pictures. On the bottom here, we have the State Department. George Marshall, Loy Henderson, and Warren Austin. He was the envoy to the United Nations. So he got up and spoke at the United Nations. Then on this side, we have Chaim Weizmann, who was the Jewish leader, kind of like the president. Not the ad hoc guy, but there was no nation. But he was the leader of the Jewish movement. And we have Eddie Jacobson, who was just a citizen who was a friend of Truman, but plays a very important role. Then over here we have assistants to Truman. One is Clark Clifford. He was not a Jewish guy, Episcopalian, but it seems to be a real level-headed thinker. And then we have a Jewish guy, David Niles. They were assistant advisors to the president. And they have one more, Oscar Ewing. And I always keep thinking JR is going to jump up here, but it's not him. But you do go Google Ewing, you'll have JR come up, so you don't want to look at him. Anyway, you have Oscar Ewing. These are the people now that are kind of important. There are others, but these are the ones we're going to talk about. Now, George Marshall, we know him from the Marshall Plan, Secretary of State, appointed in 1947. All this stuff is background stuff. The speech commenced, speech recommended European collectively create their own plan for rebuilding Europe after World War II. State Department developed most of the plan, or Truman shrewd enough to let Marshall's name be attached to it. So the Marshall Plan. You know, we're the first country in the world that I know of that destroyed a nation and went back and rebuilt it. Something wrong with that. But anyway, that was America. Maybe the Christian America has something to do with that. Unlike Truman, Marshall was widely admired. Unlike Truman. Truman wasn't that well liked. In fact, he didn't think he'd get reelected. Remember who ran against him? Dewey. Look who got elected next morning. All right. Unlike Truman, Marshall was widely admired by members of both political parties. Marshall received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1953 for the plan, blah, blah, blah. All right, so he's a very well-respected man. Truman appointed Marshall in 47, highly respected by Truman, however, against the partitioning plan. Truman, remember, Stettinius, I did this for you last week, was telling Truman, watch my step, that I didn't really understand what was going on over there, and that I ought to leave it to the experts. Whose experts? The State Department. Others in his department shared Marshall's view. In the aggregate, it seemed, Truman says in his notes, it seemed like almost from the first day the U.S. state and the defense establishment waged a relentless campaign to undermine partition and the President Prune's support for it. So we have the vote in November 21, 47. December 5, 47, a few days later, Marshall imposes an arms embargo in the Middle East. As far as I know, he didn't consult Truman. Now think about that. The Jews have few armaments. They're supposed to defend themselves. For sure, nothing of the heavy variety. The blockade seems directed right at the Jewish Jews, since how would the embargo be enforced on the Arab states? They live in land, they're landlocked, who live in continuous land. Only Jews on an island, you know, political island, would be looking towards the sea or air for delivery. So they're the only ones really that could suffer a blockade. The rest wouldn't even suffer one. How could you impose it? So Truman, now here's another good thing, good quality about Truman. Truman's faithful to his State Department, never lifted the embargo. Now, the interesting arms tale coming next week from Yugoslavia. How did the Lord provide them with arms? From another quarter, Defense Secretary James Forrestal. He warns the UN Security Council that any serious attempt to implement partition Palestine would set in motion events that would result in at least a partial mobilization of United States Armed Forces. So we have the two fears, two false fears. Arabs cannot unite under one head. They never have. If they did, we'd all be dead. Second, oil does not have to be the leverage assigned to it. All right, so don't think about it that way. Back to Marshall. Now, he says at a press conference, when asked if the United States was going to continue to support the petition, which already had been voted on by the UN Security Council, you know, like the reporters do, they want to ask these tough questions. Are you still going to support the partition? And he says the whole Palestine thing is under constant consideration. Well, that's a diplomatic answer, but it does not express Truman's answer. And what does that do? Starts mix up things. February 22, Truman instructs Marshall on a policy contingency. I think that the State Department must have pushed for, well, what if this doesn't work? Well, what if it doesn't work? Well, then Truman apparently says to, well, work up a plan, but don't implement it. If this partition thing doesn't work and we got to go to a custodialship, let's talk about it. Don't do anything unless you talk to me first. All right? That's what I'm saying in my little reading here. So we won't implement the contingency plan unless it's necessary. Well, Secretary Marshall instructs Warren Austin, who is an envoy to the UN, that tells him that if United Nations Special Assembly on Palestine were convened, the United States would support a United Nations trusteeship. Now, again, we're going against what the president has said. Now we got another person involved, and now he's going to the UN being ready to say that. So it's a contradiction of the Truman plan for partition. So it was quite clear that the State Department was out to reverse Human's Palestine policy, although the president still did not want to believe it. Now, I don't have a date on this, but I think this is really interesting. Oscar Ewing is a lawyer. And when you get in trouble, you need to go talk to your friends. And so he was a lawyer friend that Truman wanted to be assured that what he was doing was legal and appropriate. So Truman needed objective advice, speaks to his friend serving in the Federal Security Agency. Truman says, "I am in a tough spot. The Jews are emotionally involved." And he went on for quite a while talking about how difficult it was to handle these Jews. And some of them were really, this guy named Brixen, was really, really only in your face. You know, they can be that way, right? We know about it. Somebody is desperate, they really turn up the heat. So he didn't really know what to do with this. So he asked if Ewing would help, and Ewing attorney offered to help, and Ewing would. So what did he do? He investigated legal claims the Arabs and the Jews respectively had to the land in question. Now, we go back to our study of international law back in January. Wadsworth, another attorney, don't know who he is, and others had argued that with Truman that the Zionist goal might be contrary to international law and that the partition resolution had no constitutional authority to commence with a geographical change in the region. And he's right about that. Remember, the UN has no authority to change it, so that part was right. But there's a further question that has to be answered deeper or first. So Ewing's conclusion was that the international law, when land is taken by conquest, remember a defensive war, talked about that, non-aggressive war, I'm assuming that's what he's saying here, because that's the condition, taken by conquest, the conqueror can dispose of it as he desires. This means that the sovereignty given by the Allies to the Jews of land taken from Turkey, and by the way, not the Arabs, they were Turks, after World War I, has as much validity as grants of sovereignty that had been made to the Arab countries. If you can give it to the Arab countries, then you can give it to the Jews. Or you can give it to the English, or you can give it to the United States. Those is up to them to give it. So most important, he concludes, the claim that Palestine had been their land for thousands of years was untrue. For hundreds of years, it had been Turkish, not Arab. And after the First World War, the Allies had given part of their conquered land to the Jews, and their title to it became indisputable. That's what we said. Same thing. And we're not lawyers. So we had that little reprieve there to talk about, are they secure in the land? And they are, legally. Now, since the end of World War II, Zionists have had a concern for Jewish people who are still languishing in the camps of Europe. You know that. Perhaps we may be critical of the Zionists who wanted to meet with the president, seemed overbearing and without consideration for one that could help them the most, even jeopardizing their mission. So intense was the pressure to meet with the president that he cut off all contacts with the Jews. That's been tough. It is true that Truman had met with Chaim Weizmann in November to talk about the borders and to get the Negev in it. But now, February 27, 1948, you look on the map over here. Do I have February? No, I don't put that. I didn't put one that one up. It would be the second visit. It is true that Truman had met with Chaim Weizmann about the importance of including Negev, but now, 27th of February, 48, Truman, not listening to his former partner of haberdashery, Eddie Jacobson, will not meet with Weizmann again. And a long story made short, he did meet with him. The president, Truman's friend, Eddie Jacobson, walked into the White House without an appointment, and pleads with Truman to meet with Weizmann. president of the Jewish Agency of Palestine and the World Zionist Organization. Truman responds to Eddie, says, "You win, you bald-headed, and I won't say the word. I will see him." So it's interesting how these personal friendships make a difference. Here's Weissman, March 18. Truman meets with Weissman. Truman says he wishes to see justice done in Palestine without bloodshed, and that the Jewish state were declared, and the United States remained stalled in the attempt to establish trusteeship, which is not going to happen. But if it were, then it would move for an immediate recognition of a new Jewish state. I don't know why Truman said that, because except that that's what the State Department had put forth. March 18, United Nations Special Commission on Palestine reports to the United Nations Security Council that it had failed to arrange a compromise between Jews and Arab, and recommend the United Nations undertake a temporary trusteeship for Palestine in order to restore peace. They were at a deadlock. Next day, the United States representative of the United Nations, this Warren Austin, announces to the United States Security Council, United Nations Security Council, that the United States positions that the position of Palestine is no longer a partition of Palestine is no longer a viable option. A lie. Confusing. But he already met with Weissman. Weissman thinks he's going to do it. Now we hear in the public he's not going to do it. So Truman's got to save his neck and his State Department's neck, because if you have a conflict like that in the State Department, your administration goes down the tubes. So Secretary of State Marshall announces that the United States will seek to work within the United Nations to bring a peaceful settlement to Palestine, and that the proposal for a temporary United Nations trusteeship for Palestine is the only option presently considered. That's not true, but that's what he says publicly. So President Truman writes his brother, interesting, we talk about these emails that Hillary has. I mean, Truman writes all his friends about what's going on in the State Department. I wonder if he got security clearance on these things, but maybe they weren't supposed that way. I don't know. Anyway, he writes his brother regarding Palestine. I think the proper thing to do, and the thing that I have been doing all along, is to do what I think is right and let them go to, you know, the other place. An attempt at, he was colorful. All right. Maybe that's not the word you should use there. In an attempt to correct this debacle now, President Truman says at the press conference that the United Nations trustee for Palestine would be only a temporary measure. That's how he gets out of this. You know, it's not going to be temporary, can't, but still go to partition. So he said the trusteeship is not a substitute for partition. So he's hanging on to that. So President Truman, friend Eddie Jacobson, enters the White House. This is now his second time. Notices that, unnoticed by the Eastgate, meets with Truman. Jacobson records this meeting. He affirmed very strongly the promise he had made to Weissman and to me about partition, and he gave me permission to tell Weissman so, which I did. Remember, we are now 4 days, 3 days before about a month. Yeah, got about a little more than a month. It was at this meeting that I also discussed with the president the vital matter of recognizing the new state, and to this he agreed with his whole heart. So Truman is still on board here. It's at State Department. He can't get to say the right things. Now we're 2-3 days before the mandate ending. I call that the shootout at the Oval Office. President Truman meets in the Oval Office with Secretary of State George Marshall, Undersecretary Robert Lovett, Counsel to President Clark Clifford, and others. Clark Clifford is not a Jew, by the way, and this is him. Hello. This is him next to Truman. Am I pointing? There we go. This is him over here. This is Lovett. This is Marshall. Although the meeting began calmly enough, Clifford, this guy, recalled, it soon developed into the most confrontational and hostile meeting he'd ever attended during his 5 years in the Truman administration. Presentations were made about partitioning or trusteeship. At that point, Secretary Marshall spoke up. He said that it was extremely dangerous to base long-term policy on temporary military success. Apparently, it had been argued that the Jews were defending themselves, and that they were taking a gamble. He also was giving them notice that if the Jews got into trouble and came running to us, there was no warrant to expect help from the United States, which had warned them of the grave risk they were running. So he's on the wrong side, he with Truman. Next, it was Clifford's turn to speak. And apparently he said he was told to prepare this as if he's going to go to the Supreme Court and argue a case. And he had already most of it done before he talked to Truman. So anyway, he does this. First, he said, he announced his disagreement with the state's position, Marshall, or the other guy, which recommended efforts to gain truce in Palestine. Rusk, Dean Rusk, by the way, had said back in March 24 that he would be able to get one in 2 weeks, you know, this peace settlement. Everybody says that every president that's come to the Oval Office in my time is always going to make peace in the Middle East. Has anybody done it yet? No. Well, so this is still going on here, back on those days. So, I can do it in 2 weeks. And he came back and it hadn't been done yet, except it wasn't more than 2 weeks. It was back in March. Now we're in May. Second thing, Clifford noted, the trusteeship that the State Department favored presupposed a single Palestine that, Clifford said, is unrealistic. The partition into Jewish and Arab sectors had already happened. Remember the fighting? They already knew what the areas were. Jews and Arabs are already fighting each other from territory each side presently controls. Thirdly, Mr. President, Clifford said, I strongly urge you to give prompt recognition to the Jewish state immediately after the termination of the British mandate May 14. This would have the distinct value of restoring the president's firm position in support of the partition of Palestine. Remember, it's kind of weak right now. Such a move should be taken quickly before the Soviet Union or other nations recognize the Jewish state. Finally, Clifford said, since the Balfour Declaration, the Jewish people the world over have been waiting for 30 years for the promise of a homeland to be fulfilled. There is no reason to wait one day longer. Trusteeship will postpone the promise indefinitely. In fact, it will kill it because it's either partition or be annihilated. Those are the two choices the Jews sought. The United States has a great moral obligation to oppose discrimination such as that inflicted on the Jewish people. Taking words directly from the speech Truman gave as a senator in 1943 in Chicago, I showed you that last week. There must be a safe haven for people to land, a land of their own, he told them, would be one way of atoning for the atrocities committed by the Nazis. Addressing the issue of the United States' national interest, Clifford pointed to how important it was for the United States to have one friendly democracy in the Middle East of which we can rely. Now, that's political, of course. As Marshall sat listening to Clifford's words, Clifford noticed that his face was turning red. When he finished, Marshall launched into what seemed to Clifford a furious emotional attack on the positions I had just taken. Mr. President, Marshall said, I thought this meeting was called to consider an important and complicated problem in foreign policy. I don't even know why Clifford is here. He is a domestic policy advisor, and this is a foreign policy matter. Ooh. Now, Truman the Salvager. Truman answers simply, well, General, he's here because I asked him to be. Well, Marshall quickly retorted, these considerations have nothing to do with the issue. He, that is Clifford, is pressing a political consideration with regard to this issue. I don't think politics play any part of this. When Lovett finished, Marshall again erupted, saying, if the president were to follow Mr. Clifford's advice and in the election that fall, I would vote against the president. Now, there was utter silence in the room like there was now. If Marshall's threat should become public, thought Clifford, it could virtually seal the dissolution of the Truman administration and send the Western alliances right after World War II, then in a process of creation into disarray. So Truman ended the meeting quickly. Now what is he going to do? So the president attempted to salvage his secretary, Marshall, with placating words, and Clifford, tasting defeat, said he never won them all, kind of graciously. But Truman said, well, let's don't proceed on that assumption, Clark, that you've lost it. Let the dust settle. I still want to do it, but be careful. I can't afford to lose General Marshall. I mean, I think that's a statement that does that. You're trying to save his erring staff. So 2 days before May 15, we have this. Truman has made up his mind to recognize statehood. Question, when will it be recognized? Before it's announced or after? Well, it was decided to wait till after. It'd be inappropriate to do it before. Will it be recognition by de facto or de jure? Now, I'm sure you know the difference. Well, there is a difference. De facto is what they got. de jure is what they're going to get. De facto means that a nation exists and it can function. I mean, it's recognized, but it's not recognized in its permanent state. The de jure is a permanent government with even permanently set borders. So the United States will come back later and recognize the de jure, and Russia will recognize the de jure, interestingly enough. But at this point, it's de facto. So it's still recognition of the state. Okay, when it happens, or when it did happen, however you say this, the understaff of the State Department and the regular staff of the United Nations delegation are so dumbfounded, having no clue regarding what the president's policy was or has been all along. They didn't have any idea. You know, they just took it from the top, didn't question it. How would they know? Unless they told them. So cool heads prevailed. It was even an airplane ride to New York to stop the people from the UN from resigning. Cool heads prevailed, else the two departments would have resigned en masse, and that didn't happen. So May 14, 1948, late morning, Eastern Standard Time, late afternoon in Palestine, David Ben-Gurion, Israel's first prime minister, reads the Declaration of Independence, which proclaims the existence of a Jewish state called Israel, beginning May 15, 1948, at 12 o'clock midnight, Palestine time, 6 o'clock, May 14, 1948, Eastern Standard Time. 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, it was midnight in Palestine. The British mandate for Palestine expires, and the state of Israel comes into being. So we have this great picture from Tel Aviv, and in a few minutes, it's recognized by the United States. We have the letter here signed by Truman, where he crosses out state of Jewish state. He writes in State of Israel. I'm not sure he named it because they already were calling it that, but he agrees with the name. And so he calls up here provisional government, and then he dates it down here, puts a time on it, and signs his name. So what he does, what does our government say? The government has been informed that the Jewish state has been proclaimed in Palestine. By the way, they had asked for recognition first, and they did. And the government has been informed that the Jewish state has been proclaimed in Palestine, and recognition has been requested by the provisional government thereof. The United States recognized the provisional government as de facto authority of the state of Israel. So there you have it. Now, Russia. 10 minutes. Can you stick with me? We get Russia in here. The Soviet Union was the first country to recognize Israel de jure, you know, in fact, with borders even. And just for information, we of the 192 countries in the world, 160 of them today recognize Israel. You can probably pick out which ones don't. Okay, now, regarding Russia, I will take this word from Lawrence Oster. I don't know him. If he's weird, sorry. But he seemed to have a good paper here, and it checked some things out, so I think he's okay. But I don't know who he is. Always afraid to quote people unless I know who they are. So the title of his paper is Why Stalin Midwife the Birth of Israel. It's generally, he writes, I'm going to just quote him now. It's generally forgotten today that the Soviet Union played a key role in the birth of the state of Israel by supporting the partition of Palestine, and lending the Jewish state military and political support during the War of Independence. The policy represented a startling reversal of the Soviet Union's previous hardline stand against Zionism, which had been based on the notion that Zionism was a form of Western imperialism, and not unlike the Hitler-Stalin pact, caused considerable upheaval within the communist world. And of course, Russia can do what they want to do. Everybody else got to follow them. But why did Stalin so dramatically change his course? As explained in this fascinating excerpt from an article by an anti-Zionist Marxist, it had nothing to do with any belief in the Zionist cause, but with the Soviets' geopolitical aim to push Britain out of the Middle East while preventing the United States from replacing Britain as a dominant power over there as a custodialship. Probably the essential aim of Soviet foreign policy was to support Israel's struggle against British imperialism. Moscow hoped to boot the United Kingdom out of Palestine by backing the partition plan while seeking to prevent the United States from actively entering the area of Attlee's request. You know, British always wanted the United States to do this. Note, The apparent, now this is my note. Note this, the apparent, I'm looking for a hand of God in everything. Did the apparent ambivalence in the State Department give Russia the wrong signals, confident to overrun the administration's plan of trusteeship? You know, if they knew that the United States didn't want to have trusteeship, that they wanted a partition, I don't know, they would have been for it. But this mixed signal gave the Russians an opportunity to take the side against Britain. And then the secret was, the United States was with Russia. That's amazing. It's probably hoped that the small Jewish state, back to the quote, it's probably hoped that the small Jewish state would choose, remember there are a lot of the Jews were communists, not by any stretch of the imagination, a majority, there were enough of them there though. It was probably hoped that the small Jewish state would choose to be neutral and perhaps even afford a foothold in the Middle East to Russia. The Kremlin may have cherished some illusions about the progressive inclinations of the Israeli leaders, Jewish communists, Lenin, Marx, Trotsky, and so on. In any case, the Soviet Union strongly opposed any attempt to prolong the British mandate or to institute a trusteeship which would have been placed in the hands of the Western states. One fact alone demonstrates that Russia's position, rather than being inspired by any sort of sympathy for Zionism, simply expressed Stalin's desire to contribute to the collapse of the British Empire. Well, Moscow also sent arms to Syria, which was at war with Israel at the time. Moreover, the USSR refused to recognize Transjordan, which we call the West Bank today, territorial conquest in Palestine. They refused to recognize that division and didn't recognize that given to the Arabs. They would have been supportive of that going to Israel. He didn't think the Hashemite kingdom there was more than a cover for maintenance of the Jewish presence. So the unconditionality pro-Israel position of the Soviet Union in 1947-48 was therefore a part of a general opportunist line and undoubtedly revealed an underestimation of the ties between Zionist leaders and the United States. That's what they missed. Should have read his Bible. Truman did. Churchill did. Stalin probably didn't, because he was atheist. So, yet, the recognition was followed blindly by the local Communist Party, these other ones, which discredited the Arab communists among the masses, didn't care about what they thought. The Arab communists and the masses were totally disregarded in recognizing Israel. Well, how about the oil? Don't care. You know, that's one thing about decisive action. You don't worry about what's going to happen. You just do it and worry about the rest. So we have these Arab communists, didn't worry about them. We should have, our side should have not worried about them either. All the more so that the Kremlin was characteristic of Stalinist cynicism, totally discarded the interest of the Arab liberation movement. Yeah, they were all being attacked. So thus, the Soviet delegate Malik, speaking in the Security Council on May 4, 1949, in the debate on Israel's admission to the United Nations, and look what he says, flatly denies Israel's responsibility for the tragedy of the refugees. Russia is saying this. It has been said that, in respect to that, the USSR was not content with noting the practical impossibility of Arab-Jewish coexistence in the framework of a Palestinian state. They knew it couldn't work. It chose, in the words of Eli Sheff, whatever his name is, the role of Israel's godmother, and everything such policy implies. Now he says, he finishes this up, I published this for information because it shows how the birth of the Jewish state was made possible by a communist power which should have totally opposed the appearance of a Western-style democracy in the Middle East. This wholly unpredicted and unexpected turn of events suggests that the birth of the State of Israel was as providential. He goes on to explain there was parallels between the United States being formed too. So he sees the providential hand of God. I don't know who this guy is, whether he's a Christian or what, but when you read through these amazing things, you see there's somebody out here running the show. It wasn't all luck. All right, so there we are. Now we're going to have some things to fill around what happened here, because I want to make sure I got the baby born for you tonight, at least, so we got that over with. And I don't know how you go back and pick up all the places where there are touch points where it couldn't have happened otherwise, except, you know, I don't know, that takes time to do that because you go through them and there's so many of them, you just forget about them. And, you know, Yugoslavia, the arms that's going to come out of Yugoslavia is going to be one of those examples, because Yugoslavia really is not yet Russian satellite at this time, Soviet satellite at this time. So they're selling these, you know, arms to Israel without any restraint. No one's stopping them, you know. There's no blockade from the land. Now, I always wondered about the arms from Yugoslavia. Have you ever did you ever drive in a Yugo? But maybe the arms are better. But a lot of these arms really came out of the Second World War. And there's stories about this. I was reading one site yesterday, and I got so intrigued by it, all the things that were happening, you know, in terms of airplanes and guns. And one guy, you know, and the United States made this stuff surplus, but they had to decommission the military, demilitarize them. Yeah, so they're just a piece of junk. But this guy walks in during this guy's lunch hour one time and sees all these machine guns stacked up that had not been demilitarized. And he saw this stack over here that had been, so he just switches them. And so he gets the ones that have not been, you know, switched out yet, did not been denuded yet. So all these kind of things are just amazing. I know their airplanes flew illegally, and they came from South America, and they flew these four-engines planes and brought in stuff. I mean, all this kind of stuff, it takes a lot of ingenuity, and obviously the hand of God was with them. And anyway, they got their arms, and the Arabs really weren't that prepared. I mean, they were already, that was one thing the State Department wasn't honest with Truman. They sort of said, all those Arabs, they're going to just, you know, wipe up, you know, the Jews. But they weren't. They couldn't do it. They were not organized. They didn't have training that they did. And the only ones that had any training at all would be those that would be in Jordan. And they weren't all that excited about coming over and fighting across the Jordan River anyway. So all this stuff is just, it's just absolutely amazing. You get almost bogged down in it. I'm not recommending many books, but I would mention this one for you, if you are interested in, to call this A Safe Haven. It's on Truman's issue with the Israel. By this Radish and Radish, I guess must be brother or something. So that's a good book. There are other books, but this one is accessible, I mean available. There's others that aren't. Anyway, something for you to read if you want more information. Thanks for taking the 10 minutes. It's about what I thought it would be. So see, it's 10 minutes is, I owe you now. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for the time again together this evening, and Lord, for the marvelous hand, marvelous evidence of your hand in this period of time. Lord, realize that it doesn't happen every day where a nation is born, where your hand is so obviously working in so many lives to further a purpose that you predicted and prophesied in the Scripture. Thank you, Lord, for the truth it gives us and for the confidence we have that other things you've said in the Scripture are just as true. And one of the things we read in the Scriptures is our own sinfulness and the need for a Savior. And Lord, we realize that not from our own experience, but from our experience, what we see it in the Scripture is as the way you have assessed our condition. And in that condition, you sent your only Son to be our sin bearer, to pay the sins for us, that we might be forgiven, and that our status will be changed from a guilty sinner to a forgiven sinner. Thank you, Lord, for that truth. And now as we continue to study the land and the people of Israel, realizing that the last chapter has not been written yet, although you have written it in the Scripture, but we look forward to the days that are ahead of us, and it gives us a feeling that the days are short when you'll return back again to this earth that you promised you would, and restore your people to yourself, and bring the kingdom that you promised from back in the days of Abraham to fruition. Thank you, Lord, for bringing us together tonight. Keep us safe as we go home, and may our lives be a blessing to others as we meet them. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.